Pull up a chair. I want you to stand in front of an airplane with me. She's sitting under museum lights now, polished aluminum, 4 radial engines quiet, 10 machine gun positions bristling out of her like she's still expecting company. On her nose, painted by a fellow named Tony Starcer off a magazine pinup, there's a girl in a blue bathing suit. And underneath, in a script that a whole generation would come to know, 2 words, Memphis Belle. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger. And this is The Hangar. Today we're going to talk about a flying fortress that did something almost nobody expected a heavy bomber crew to do in the spring of 1943. She finished 25 combat missions over occupied Europe, and she brought her boys home. Then she nearly rotted into the ground for the crime of getting old, and it took 13 years of somebody's stubborn love to save her. So, settle in. This is a good one. Before we get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And if there was ever a subject about a machine where every rivet tells a story, it's this one. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back. Picture England, early 1943. The 8th Air Force is trying to prove a theory. The theory is daylight precision bombing, the idea that you could send a formation of heavy bombers over Europe in broad daylight, put bombs on a factory or a submarine pen from 4 miles up and survive. The British had tried daylight raids early in the war, gotten mauled, and gone to bombing at night. The Americans said, no, we'll do it in the daytime. We'll fly tight formations, we'll stack our guns so every airplane protects every other airplane, and we'll hit what we aim at. The problem was the numbers. In those early months, the loss rates were brutal. A crewman in a B-17 in the spring of 43 had, on paper, worse odds of finishing his tour than a man had of surviving the trenches in the First World War. The Army told these crews they had to fly 25 missions to go home. 25. And in that stretch of the war, the statistics said most men would be dead or in a prison camp long before they got there. Now here's where it gets interesting. The B-17F named Memphis Belle rolled out of a Boeing plant, went to war with the 91st Bomb Group out of a base called Bassingbourne, and started grinding out missions. Her pilot was a young captain named Robert Morgan from Asheville, North Carolina. And the name on the nose, the Belle herself, she was named for Morgan's sweetheart back home, a Memphis girl named Margaret Polk. Think about what a mission actually was for these men. There was no heat to speak of. You climbed to 25,000 feet and the outside air was 50, 60 degrees below zero. Men wore electrically heated suits that failed as often as they worked, and if yours quit, you could get frostbite that would cost you fingers before you ever saw a German fighter. You breathed through an oxygen mask, and if the tube froze up with the moisture from your own breath, you could pass out and die quietly in your position while the airplane droned on. The waist gunners stood at open windows in that hurricane of freezing air, firing 50 caliber machine guns at fighters that came slashing through the formation at closing speeds you could barely comprehend. The ball turret gunner, the smallest man on the crew, usually curled up in a plexiglass sphere hanging under the belly of the airplane, spinning, hunting, absolutely alone out there in the cold. And when the flak started, the anti-aircraft fire, there was nothing anybody could do. You couldn't dodge it. You flew straight and level through it because the bombardier had the airplane on the bomb run, and you did not deviate. The sky would fill up with black puffs, and each puff was a shell that was throwing steel fragments in every direction. And you just flew through it and listened to the pieces rattle off the aluminum, like somebody throwing gravel at a tin roof. That was one mission. The Memphis Belle and her crew did that 25 times. Targets like the submarine pens at Lorient and Saint-Nazaire, where the U-boats that were strangling the Atlantic convoys hid under concrete roofs so thick the bombs barely dented them. Wilhelmshaven, Bremen, the rail yards, the docks, the aircraft factories. Each one a long, cold, terrifying trip over water and then over enemy territory, with fighters waiting on the way in and waiting again on the way out. She got shot up, of course she did. The Belle came home with holes in her wings, with a shot-out tail wheel, with control cables hanging by threads, with engines feathered and shut down. They replaced those engines over the course of her tour, replaced parts of her tail, patched her skin again and again. There's an old debate among the people who love this airplane about how much of the original Belle is even original, and how many airplanes she used up and parts over 25 missions. But the airframe kept flying, and more to the point, every man who climbed aboard her came home. Not a single crewman on the Memphis Belle was killed on her missions. In that spring, in that campaign, that was close to a miracle. Now, there's a piece of this story that's a little tangled up, and I want to be honest with you about it, the way an old pilot ought to be. For years, the Memphis Belle was called the first 8th Air Force heavy bomber to complete 25 missions and send its crew home to the States. The truth, as the historians have sorted it out since, is a little more complicated. There were other airplanes right in that same window, a B-17 called Hell's Angels among them, that reached 25 right around the same time, or even a hair before. What made the Memphis Belle the famous one wasn't just the number. It was the camera. Because the Army Air Forces needed a story. They needed to show the folks back home that this could be done, that a crew could beat the odds and come home whole, that buying war bonds and building these bombers was worth it. And there was a Hollywood director in uniform named William Wyler, a serious filmmaker who went up in these airplanes over Europe with color cameras to film the real thing. Men died making that footage. One of Wyler's cameramen was killed in the air. Wyler himself lost the hearing in one ear from the engines and the guns. Wyler and his crews filmed the Memphis Belle, and in 1944 he released a documentary in color called simply The Memphis Belle, a story of a flying fortress. And that film, real combat footage, real flak, real young faces, put this one airplane and this one crew into the heart of the whole country. The Belle and her boys came home and toured the United States selling war bonds, this proof that you could fly into that meat grinder and walk away. That's how an airplane becomes a legend. Not just what she did, but the fact that somebody was there to tell it true. And here's the part that ought to make every one of us sit up. After the war, the Memphis Belle should have gone where almost all of them went. To the scrapyards. There were thousands upon thousands of these bombers. And when the shooting stopped, the country that built them didn't need them anymore. They flew fleets of them out to the desert, to places like Kingman, Arizona. And they chopped them up, melted them down, turned the airplanes that won the air war into pots and pans and window frames. A B-17 that cost a fortune and cost lives became scrap aluminum by the pound. The Belle almost went that way too. She was headed for the smelter. The city of Memphis, Tennessee stepped in and bought her. Bought her for a few hundred dollars, essentially saved her from the chopping block because of the name and the fame and the film. And that was the good news. The bad news is what came after, because saving an airplane and caring for an airplane are two very different things. For decades, the Memphis Belle sat outdoors. She was displayed on a pole, on a pedestal, out in the Tennessee weather, in the sun and the rain and the humidity. Souvenir hunters climbed on her and pried pieces off her. Birds got inside her. Water got inside her. Vandals got inside her. The most famous bomber in America sat out there slowly going back to the earth, corroding, her skin dulling, her insides filling up with the leavings of pigeons and time. There were people in Memphis who fought hard to protect her, who moved her, who built a pavilion, who did everything a city with limited means could do. But an airplane like this needs more than good intentions. She needs a hangar, a climate, and an army of skilled hands. Now here's where it gets interesting, one more time. In 2005, the decision was made to bring the Memphis Belle to the National Museum of the United States Air Force, up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and the restoration crews up there, the professionals and the volunteers who live and breathe these old airframes, they took her in, and they looked at what 60-odd years had done to her. It was bad. Corrosion everywhere, pieces missing. Pieces that had been restored over the years in ways that weren't accurate to how she actually looked in 1943. They made a decision, and it's the decision that separates a real restoration from a quick paint job. They decided to take their time and get her right. 13 years. 13 years those men and women worked on the Memphis Belle. They didn't just make her look pretty. They researched her. They dug into the records, the photographs, the film, to find out exactly what she looked like on the day she finished her 25th mission. Right down to the placement of the patches and the exact shade and lettering of the nose art. They wanted the girl on the nose to be the girl Tony Starcer painted, not somebody's later guess. They stripped away decades of corrosion. They fabricated parts that no longer existed, or found original parts, hunting them down the way you and I might hunt for one specific bolt for a project in the back of the hangar. Except their project was a national treasure. They preserved what was original wherever they possibly could, because there's a difference between a restored airplane and a rebuilt one, and the good crews know that every original rivet is a piece of the actual history, not a reproduction of it. And on the 17th of May 2018, exactly 75 years to the day after the Memphis Belle flew that 25th mission back in 1943, they rolled her out onto the museum floor and opened her up to the public. Now she hangs in that World War II gallery among the other giants, and you can walk right up under her. And I'll tell you, if you ever get to Dayton, you go do it. You stand under that airplane, and you look up at those 10 gun positions, and you think about 10 young men in 50 below cold, breathing through frozen masks, flying straight and level through the flak 25 times, because their country asked them to, and because they weren't going to let each other down. Robert Morgan, the pilot, lived a long life. He flew B-29s in the Pacific later in the war, named one of those for Margaret II. He passed away in 2004 before the Great Restoration was finished, but he saw his airplane saved. Margaret Polk, the Memphis Belle herself, the girl the airplane was named for, she and Morgan didn't end up together, life goes the way it goes, but that name on the nose outlived them both and it'll outlive all of us. Here's what I keep coming back to. We nearly lost her, not to the Germans, not to the flak, not to the fighters. We lost thousands of these airplanes to the smelter and to neglect and to the plain fact that when a war ends, the world wants to forget the machines that won it. The Memphis Belle survived the enemy and then almost didn't survive us. She sat on a pole in the rain for decades while the country she saved half forgot her. And the only reason you can stand under her today is that some people refused to let her go, a city that bought her for scrap value, historians who dug for the truth of her, and a restoration crew that gave 13 years of their working lives to a pile of corroded aluminum because they understood something, that an airplane like this isn't aluminum. It's 10 young men. It's a whole generation. It's the proof, hanging there under the lights, that ordinary people did the impossible and came home. That's what a museum airplane really is, not a relic, a witness. My thanks to the National Museum of the United States Air Force and its restoration team, whose published accounts of the 13-year effort tell that story far better than I can, and to William Wyler, whose wartime documentary put the Belle on film when it counted. The history of Robert Morgan and his crew comes down to us through their own memoirs and the museum's records. You can find us at radiohangar.com. Next time you're anywhere near Dayton, go stand under her for me. This is Taildragger, wishing you tailwinds and soft fields. Take care of the old airplanes. They took care of us.